From the studios of KPCW here in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. This morning, Scott Greenberg and Lynn Ware Peak will speak with Becky Schnexter, communications manager at Adventure Scientist, to talk about a new partnership to make national parks plastic-free. Then physicist Dr. Maggie Thompson, who has been keeping her eyes and telescopes trained on distant planets, explores the formation and evolution of rocky exoplanets and their atmospheres. We'll have all that for you coming up in just a minute. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg. Based in Bozeman, Montana, adventure scientists connect the power of outdoor adventure with the urgency of conservation. By training and mobilizing volunteers to gather hard-to-access field data, they fuel research that would otherwise be too costly or time-intensive. Along the way, they transform adventures and communities into ambassadors for the wild places and species they serve, making science more impactful, visible, and unstoppable. Today, we're joined by Becky Schnexer, communications manager, adventure scientist, to talk about a new partnership to make national parks plastic-free. Volunteers nationwide are helping to track waste in our national parks and federal lands, data that will shape science-based solutions to tackle plastic pollution. Becky, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. I'm very excited.
Well, we're excited to have you. So let's start off. Can you tell us about Adventure Scientists and its overall mission?
Yes, absolutely. And what an amazing introduction. You hit on a lot of our mission there, but we are a nonprofit that seeks to connect outdoor adventurers with meaningful scientific impact. So what we do is we partner with scientists, like you said earlier, that need data sets, especially in hard to reach places. And what better way to help those scientists than to find the adventurers that are already going to these hard to reach places? They already have the skills to get to these extreme environments. And why not ask them and train them, mobilize them to also add a little scientific impact to their outdoor adventure? So that's what we do. And I love that you brought up our collaboration with Five Gyres for plastic-free parks, because that's also what we're doing with that project, is mobilizing people who are already going into national parks, especially for us, the adventurers that are going off trail and going to the further, less explored areas of national parks, and spreading that scientific impact.
I mean, they're already out there, right? I mean, you know, they're having a good time, and they might as well do good while they're having a good time. And I'm just kind of curious, what inspired this partnership to make national parks plastic-free in the first place?
Yeah, that is a great question. We have an amazing collaborator, Five Gyres, who already does incredible work to create plastic-free national parks, but also public lands. So they really already had this idea to mobilize community members who are already visiting national parks and public lands across the United States. And they reached out to us to see if we would be willing to mobilize our volunteers for the project. And of course, we said absolutely. And on top of that, we're going to encourage our volunteers to go to the harder to reach places within these national parks and within these public lands. So we already knew, Five Gyres initiated the project, we already knew that pollution, specifically plastic pollution, is an issue in our national parks and in our federal lands. And so we chose to collaborate with them and help this cause.
Can you tell me a little bit more about Five Gyres? I don't think I've ever heard of it. I'm not familiar with them.
Yeah, thank you for asking. Five Gyres is another nonprofit, and they seek to mobilize volunteers, community members to go into national parks areas. And their main focus is plastic pollutions, and they really focus on microplastics, which have been found around the world in some of the most remote areas, which demonstrates how big of an issue plastic pollution, and in particular, microplastics are. So their main mission is really to tackle plastic pollution globally.
Okay, and so what is the biggest issue that we're facing in our national parks? What does the data tell us right now about plastics and microplastics in national parks?
Yeah, that's a great question. What we know is that plastic pollution is infiltrating a lot of our national parks, these harder to reach places. So knowing that, plastic pollution is a huge problem across the United States in our national parks. But what we're finding is that these microplastics, these little bits of plastics that have been broken up over time and are found in common litter items and even in clothing and detergents, it is winding up. We are finding these things in more remote areas. So off the beaten trail, in areas that have very little human inhabitation or visitation, we're finding plastics there when we do visit these places, which means that the microplastics are finding their ways into these places. So the sheer amount of plastic pollution is being distributed by waterways, by land, by animals. And so that's really where the problem is. Not just that the plastic pollution exists, that is a problem, but it's being distributed around the world globally and in these harder to reach places. And that's a huge problem because it becomes a part of ecosystems. It becomes a part of bird nests. It gets into food systems. Even us as humans, consumers, we are consuming these microplastics because it's so ingrained in the ecosystems around us.
So Becky, I want to know how we are, or how your organization is actually encouraging volunteers to collect samples. Are they, not to be indelicate, but are they looking at the animal feces? Or are they taking actual samples from animals? Or are they taking soil samples? How are we collecting the data about microplastics in national parks?
Yeah, that's a great question, because you can collect microplastic samples in a lot of different ways. For this particular project, what we're doing is volunteers are going out, and as they're enjoying the national park or a federal land, they're using an application on their phone. And when they see a piece of plastic pollution, they're logging it on their phone. They're telling the application, this is what I found. This is how many. This is the category of plastic waste that it is. This is the location that I'm finding it. And then they are picking up that litter and taking it out of the park with them. So this is a very accessible way to contribute to community-based science, especially around microplastics. But yeah, the gist of it is, as you're out enjoying the national park, you're picking up the litter, you're logging it into the application, and that data is all being compiled by Five Gyres.
Okay, so is there an app for that on their phone?
Yeah, there is. There is a free application called Trash Blitz, and that is what you load onto your smartphone, and it's pretty intuitive. Once you open it up and you select Plastic Free Parks Project, there's a lot of different projects in there. So you might find one that's hyper localized to where you are, or you can contribute to just the main project, Plastic Free National Parks.
Okay, that's pretty cool. I mean, technology these days, right? There's an app for everything.
That's right.
Including, let's find plastics in parks. So the volunteers, I mean, they're already there. They're probably people that are very, very invested in nature already, since they're making the effort to go to a national park. So this allows them to be part ecotourist and part, for lack of a better word, plastic park ranger.
Yes, I love that you characterized it that way. And Five Gyres even has a program of ambassadors. So you can be a Five Gyres ambassador or a National Parks Plastic Pollution Ranger. I love that. I think we should pitch that to Five Gyres and say, what do you think about this? But they do have an ambassador program where their volunteers can apply and they can be an integral part of the mission in spreading awareness about these types of projects.
And how is Five Gyres or your organization making management decisions in the parks based on the data they're finding?
I know after each season of the Plastic Free Parks Initiative, this project, there's a project report that releases the findings of all of the data that's been compiled in the application so that this is publicly known. It's posted on the Five Gyres website, and then that is delivered to national park policymakers and those administrators that are in charge of making these holistic decisions. So the data is handed to those folks so that they can make those management decisions.
And will your volunteers experience changes from this partnership? I mean, as a visitor, am I going to be impacted by what's going on today when I maybe camp or even buy food in the parks? Are we going to see the park system using less plastics in the future? Are they in a partnership with you and Five Gyres to actually use the data to make meaningful changes?
Yeah, and I think we've already seen over time, especially through this project, that decisions are being made to transform what kinds of packaging is being used and what are the materials being used, where making more accessible places to deposit trash rather than, you know, the choice being made, you know, I don't have anywhere to put the trash. What should I do? And unfortunately, some people choose to just lay it on the ground or let it go. So we're already seeing changes in the types of materials, the available receptacles for trash, should trash be something that is brought into the park or needed to be deposited outside. There's also encouragement for visitors to take what they bring with them out of the park to also help this initiative. But I think we've seen over time these smaller changes happening. And as we gain smaller, we put all these small changes together, it becomes a larger impact.
So back in the day when I used to scuba dive a lot, and I was actually doing a lot of underwater photography, we had a saying in the community where you take only pictures, leave only bubbles. And I love that philosophy. I love the idea that if you visit a national park or actually anywhere, you go anywhere, you know, whatever you bring with you, you should be very conscientious about maybe packing it back out with you, whether it's a national park or even just visiting a city park on a sunny day with a picnic. But getting back to the national parks, what are the role are the park staff playing in this transition? And I assume it's a transition. I assume that there's maybe even federal funding or maybe even some federal guidelines to help us reduce our plastics in the park. But what role are the park staff themselves playing in this transition?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one that I'm not sure that I know 100% the answer to, but I do know that they receive this data. So they understand what kinds of pollution is being found in the national parks and where, and using that to make changes in perhaps policies or the types of materials that are available in gift shops and in ranger stations where supplies are able to be gathered. So in terms of their involvement, I know that they receive the data and are making decisions based on that, but I'm not 100% certain exactly what that handoff looks like.
Well, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Becky Schnexer, Communications Manager at Adventure Scientist, talk about a new partnership to make national parks plastic-free, which is very exciting to me. I'd like to see a plastic-free national park. Becky, what excites you personally about leading the communications project for this initiative?
Oh, goodness. I love being able to spread the word about impact-filled initiatives and in ways that anyone can get involved, especially those who are passionate about the outdoors. I love being able to spread the word about how to get involved. And then I also love hearing back from volunteers about their experiences. Maybe they went off trail and they saw something amazing, or they went off trail and they found no plastic pollution. That's a great win. Also learning and hearing about how participating in these types of projects has impacted them personally. We have volunteers that have made career changes. We've had volunteers that have participated as families, and you see the children grow up and head into their post-high school years and choosing environmental-based careers. And I think not only is it exciting as a communications person to be able to spread the word about these initiatives, but then to also hear and spread the word about the impact that it has on the folks that choose to join these initiatives.
I am so sorry that this is only an audio portion of our podcast. I wish our listeners could see your enthusiasm. You are infectious. It is amazing to see how excited you are about this program. And I never really even thought about the plastics in our national parks until today. And now I'm going to be very, very aware of that. Now, I know adventure scientists rely heavily on volunteers. And as you said, many of them get excited themselves about, you know, their participation in this. But how do you recruit everyday people to take part in this scientific project?
It really depends on where projects are located and the types of folks that we feel would be instrumental in gathering data. So for this particular project, it's pretty accessible. Anyone who has access to a national park, is available to participate in this. So what we really do is just look for folks that are outdoorsy people. They enjoy being outside. They're already planning on going to national parks, or we've heard from them that they are heading to a specific area, such as a national park, and they want to get involved. So it's a little bit different if we have a different kind of project. For example, we in the past have had projects that are based in forests. So the recruitment are looking for the kinds of people that are willing to go into a forest in the dead of winter is slightly different than a summer project where folks are traveling to national parks. So for this one, it's really anyone who likes to be outside, even families going on vacation or trail runners that are heading out into these national parks to do their trail running preparation, or they've prepared for a big trail run and they're heading into the national parks.
I find this fascinating that you can find people who are excited about this. I find it encouraging as well. But how are you getting the word out? I mean, other than shows like ours, Cool Science Radio, which we are very happy to spread the word about this program, what other programs or what other avenues do you take, Becky, to get the word out that people can participate in a program like this?
So we use social media to spread the word and making sure that our audiences are broad and they're anything that we post is getting to the locations that are in close proximity to our projects. But we also, if there's a project, for example, in Utah, you can do plastic-free parks. If we look for local affinity groups, right? Trail runners that are in close proximity to the national park that we are targeting, or we're looking for mountain bikers. We look for those mountain bike communities, and then we talk to them and say, hey, we know you guys are out there, you're shredding, you're going to these amazing, hard to reach places. And we talk to them about, what do you think about adding a little scientific impact to that mountain bike run, or the trail run that you're going on, or I know oftentimes people will plan big trips around specific hiking trails. I know this isn't in Utah, but the PCT in California, if we know we have a project close to there, then we seek out folks that are going, they're planning expeditions or trips to go on these specific trails, and we talk to them about adding a little scientific impact to their outdoor adventures.
Now, I do think it's all about communication and information and education. So, for example, personally, here in Park City, Utah, they take samples during ski season of the snow and then report back to the community about the PFAS concentration, because evidently, until recently, ski wax contained a lot of PFAS. I had no idea. I didn't know. I would just take my skis in to get them waxed, or I would do it myself at home, and had no idea that I was actually contributing to a problem of plastics in our environment. But now that we know, we actually have a program here that allows us to turn in old ski wax or any ski wax that has PFAS in it. And we've seen a reduction now and the concentration of PFAS in our snow season over season. It's not zero yet. We're going for zero, because guess what? When that snow melts, it turns into liquid water, obviously, and runs off into our reservoirs, and we drink that water. So it's really super important here in the local community to be made aware of that kind of impact that microplastics is having right here that we would never think about. I would never think about it. I wasn't even aware of it. I'm curious, do you have a story from the field that illustrates maybe the human impact of plastics in wild places that you want to share with us?
Yeah, great. Great question. Microplastics in wild places, of course. So we have, historically, we had a project called Wild and Scenic Rivers, where we mobilized kayakers and those who like to adventure in rapid-based water sources. And with that project, we were looking at water samples, and our volunteers who went out, I'm thinking of one particular couple who went out together. They went on their adventure. They chose their Wild and Scenic River. And they had some great stories about their adventure to find the spot that they were going to sample. They may or may not have had a little scenic route involved, a little detour, accidental detour. But everything turned out fine, right? Adventurers know what to do. We have an accidental scenic tour. We turn it into an adventure and a learning opportunity and part of the broader story. But this couple went out to their identified wild and scenic river, and they took their samples. They came back, they sent them back to us, and we realized that the levels, I believe it was the pH, didn't necessarily make sense for the water source where they were taking samples. So we reached back out and we said, hey friends, we know you had quite the adventure going and getting those samples. Something doesn't seem quite right about the water chemistry values that we're seeing in the lab. Do you mind going back out and doing those samples again? And of course, right, they're adventure scientist volunteers. They are looking for an excuse to get back out there and do an adventure and then add some science on the side. So they went back out and had an even larger adventure, because the water level by the time they went back out was slightly lower than it was before. So the kayaking that they were doing was interesting, but they were able to go out and get those samples. And the second set of samples that they sent in, the readings were a lot, they seemed a lot more accurate than the first round. So I hope that that helps you with your question. That was the first.
Yeah, but I'm just curious, do we ever know what the difference was between the two samples?
Yes, I know that we do know the difference in those two samples. Up the top of my head, I do not know, but I feel like that story represents to you, or represents generally, how invested our volunteers are, how excited they are to add the scientific impact, and then our communication back and forth. It's not just you go out, you get a sample, you make an observation, you submit it, and you never hear from us again. We're actively working with our scientific partners to make sure, okay, great, the sample came in, it looks good, it's within normal parameters, and then eventually we'll be able to communicate what that data actually meant. But there's a great check and communication back and forth that happens to make sure that the science and the samples being collected are of high quality. And if for some reason they're not, then we go back to the volunteers and ask them nicely if they could go back out and do that again. And to ensure that not only are we successfully capturing data, but that that data is accurate.
That is a great story. Hopefully they had less detours on the second adventure back out to collect that those additional samples. Becky, how are you going to measure success in this project? What does a plastic-free national park really look like? Not just to you, but to the community who uses the national parks.
Yeah, that's a great question. And there's many components to it. I think we can measure success in many ways. We can measure it by the amount of people, the density of people that we can get out there collecting data. We can measure our success by the amount of data that is collected, not only the number of people, volunteers that are mobilized to go out and collect that, but the density of data that is being collected. I think it's a win to get folks out there and collecting the data and collecting that pollution and getting it out of the park. That's also a metric of success. But also, what happens next? How do we look at the data and better understand not only that plastic pollution exists or not in specific areas in national parks, but what kinds of plastic? And that gives us a better depiction. Is it primarily single-use food wrappers? Is it single-use food wrappers from a very specific place? Is it single-use objects such as a straw, which isn't a food wrapper, but it is a food mechanism, I suppose? Or is it something completely different? Is it bottle caps? What exactly is the plastic being found? What's the density of it? And then what does that tell us as a society? What does that tell us as folks that are going into the park? What are the items that are being left behind? And how can we minimize that number of items and the density of the plastic that we're finding? I think it also, a success metric is who receives that data. So you might be a volunteer receiving that data and better understanding what the project found. You might be the National Park Service that's receiving that data and what happens next. You might be someone who didn't even know about the project until the data has been delivered, and it's more of an awareness that this is a project, this is a problem, and motivating folks to make small decisions or small behavioral changes wherever they are, whether they're in a national park or not. So there are a lot of different ways to measure success. And I can confidently say we're doing all those things in collaboration with Five Gyres. We're looking at the data from a lot of different angles to better understand what we can do in the future. I think ultimately, if we could find zero plastics in our national parks, that's, boy, would that be a success. I'm not sure how realistic that is right now, but these small pieces over time should help us reach that goal.
As I said earlier, your enthusiasm is infectious, and I am excited, excited about this project. I think it's so cool, and I think that a plastic-free national park would be amazing, but I also think that this could literally spread globally, and maybe one day we have plastic-free ecosystems around the world.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
I've been speaking with Becky Schnexer from Adventure Scientists, sharing how science and partnerships are tackling the challenges of plastic waste in our national parks. If you'd like to learn more about their work or even volunteer to contribute to future projects, visit adventurescientists.org. Becky, thank you so much for joining me on Cool Science Radio today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And as always, thank you, our audience, for tuning into Cool Science Radio. And until the next time, remember, stay curious.
Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
Did you ever wonder if there might be other planets in the universe that could possibly sustain life?
Well, our guest today, Dr. Maggie Thompson, has been keeping her eyes and telescopes trained on distant planets, exploring the formation and evolution of rocky exoplanets and their atmospheres.
Dr. Thompson has been studying the chemical diversity of magma exoplanets and the connection between their interiors and their atmospheres using a combination of laboratory experiments and theoretical modeling tools. She incorporates these experimental findings into coupled interior atmosphere climate models to answer important questions about these hot, rocky worlds. Maggie, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
I always think it's fun whenever we get to talk about exoplanets. And every time I have to sort of remind myself what an exoplanet is and why we care. So why don't you give us that?
Yeah, absolutely. So exoplanets are the term that the community has come up with to describe planets that orbit stars other than our sun. So the planets that are in our solar system, we refer to as planets, and then anything that's going around another star, we call exoplanet. And in the last, basically since I've been alive in the last 30 plus years is really when this field has taken off, and we've had amazing technological achievements to be able to actually discover these planets, because it's very hard. Our stars are so bright. So we're looking for basically, it's like the equivalent of being in California trying to look at a lamppost in New York City and see a firefly like going around it and detect that firefly. It's really amazing, the technology that we've come up with.
That is amazing. And I believe the first exoplanet was discovered in the early 1990s, maybe? Like you said, about 30 years. It's interesting because, as you know, Mars has been in the most recent news, being that there's been more conclusive suggestion of the possibility of life on Mars this week. And so it's really interesting to now draw a parallel between, you know, Mars is in our solar system, meaning it orbits our star, which is the sun. What is it that Mars has in common with exoplanets? I know they're both like these rocky entities, shall we say?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of parallels. And actually, one of the big goals of exoplanet science is to try and put our solar system and the planets that we have sort of into this wider context. You know, one of the things that we don't know for sure yet is our solar system very common, where we have these small rocky planets, so like Mars, stars, ourselves, Earth, Venus, and then even Mercury being really small in the inner part of the solar system. And then we have Jupiter and Saturn and these bigger gas giant planets in the outer solar system. So we want to understand whether that is a common configuration based off of actually what we've been discovering so far. And we have some bias here, you know, because these planets are very hard to detect. So right now we're really sensitive to bigger ones and ones that are closer in to their stars. But it's suggesting that maybe not. Maybe our solar system actually is not the most common configuration. We have a lot of systems that maybe just have smaller planets that are really close in. We also have some planet that we've found, actually the most abundant ones that we found so far, we have no parallel for in our solar system. So we've called them super Earths. So planets that are bigger than Earth, and we're still trying to actually understand, you know, what their atmospheres are like, what these planets are like. And then we also have another type called mini Neptunes. So we've used words that describe planets in our solar system, like Earth or Neptune. But there's this other big population of planets that are a little smaller than Neptune, but also incredibly common. So it's a great question. And for Mars in particular, and thinking about life in the solar system, you know, I think our best hope for a very long time to actually get direct samples from other planets, of course, are going to remain in our solar system. So understanding if life was ever on Mars is a really important question for us to look at life around other planets in general. And of course, we've found some smaller planet, you know, that could be potentially Mars-like, where they have a very, very, very thin atmosphere. It may even be very hard for us to even detect this atmosphere if it's for a planet that's farther away around a different star.
Okay, so we're talking about detection, and you used the analogy of looking for a firefly around a lamppost in New York City all the way from California. I love the idea of looking up into the stars and trying to figure this all out, but are there specific instruments or are there specific experiments that you use to try to detect exoplanets? It sounds like it's a pretty hard thing to do.
It's very hard, yes. And so, I mean, the tools, and I think we're kind of seeing a shift in the field where for the last, 30 years when we've been discovering these exoplanets, the goal has been detecting them. You know, we just want to know how many planets are out there and, you know, basic properties. So for example, how massive they are, what's their mass and also what's their size. And so to do that, we have different tools that look at, one is measuring the brightness from a star. And then as a planet, we have to be lucky enough that the viewing at which we are looking at this star and the geometry for the way the system is configured is just so that the planet passes right in front of it. And so you see this little dip in the starlight, and that is due to the planet blocking some of that light passing in front. A lot of what I focus on is thinking about light. And so one of the exciting things about this method is you can even measure what is in the atmosphere of these planets. So as the planet passes in front of the star, then if any of that starlight passes through the atmosphere of that planet, say there's, molecules like we have in our atmosphere, we have, carbon dioxide, for example, then those molecules will absorb some of that light and cause some characteristic dips and wiggles if you take that light and you spread it out over wavelengths. So basically spectroscopy is essentially what that is. And that tool is extremely powerful. It is the way that we understand what are these planets actually like. And so the shift that I mentioned at the beginning, I think, is now moving into characterizing these planets. So now we maybe know their mass and their size, but we also want to know, what's in their atmosphere? What are these planets actually like? It's a very, very exciting time.
And are you using things like the James Webb telescope? Are we using the Hubble, or is this more ground-based observatory work?
So it's all of the above. I mean, for my work specifically, I'm really interested in what the James Webb Space Telescope is going to tell us, because that's one of our best tools for looking at what's in these planets' atmospheres. And so what I do, actually, I have a lot of colleagues that are incredibly gifted at planning out these observations that they will do with JWST. And I'm interested in taking their data and trying to see if we can basically explain it with experiments in the lab. So one of the really nice and exciting things about exoplanets, and in particular looking at rocky exoplanets, is that we have a lot of tools that traditionally were used in Earth science to look at understanding our Earth. And we can now apply that and change up some of the compositions or some of the conditions that we're looking at in the lab to try to say, okay, how do we reproduce the atmosphere that we are observing for some of these exoplanets? You know, how do we explain how water in the atmosphere got there, how carbon dioxide got there?
Maggie, what is the most famous, the most well-known, and or your most favorite exoplanet?
Oh, that is a great question. Well, so this is, I will cheat slightly and say there's a particular system that I quite like. So this has multiple exoplanets. But I think one of the most famous ones is this one called TRAPPIST-1. It's a system that was discovered several years ago now. It's been known for quite a while, and it has seven transiting, so meaning that these planets from our viewing go past in front of their star. Seven planets that are all kind of rocky in size. And so they have been a huge priority target for JWST to see, you know, are there atmospheres around these planets? Some of them are located just in terms of how far they are from their star in the region that we call the habitable zone, which is where if water was on these planets, it would exist in liquid form, like the temperature would be just right. And of course, this also depends on what the atmosphere is made up. And there's a lot of unknowns here, but it's in that nice spot, just like Earth is around our sun, where if you have water, it could be stable in liquid form. So that's my favorite. I think it's super exciting, and it's been a challenge. So of course we've had JWST now for several years, but the star that the TRAPPIST-1 star, the system that these planets orbit around, is what we call an M dwarf star. So it's not nearly as bright as our sun, and these M dwarfs tend to pitch bigger fits than our sun does. So they have a lot of solar flares, and they have a lot of spots on them. And so they make interpreting the data that we're getting quite challenging. And there's amazing people in the field that this is their whole focus, you know, is trying to understand these M dwarfs. And it's so important because we need to understand the star before we can understand the planet. But I think there's so much promise in this system and is going to tell us so much about rocky worlds.
So interesting. So when we talk about a lot of solar storms on our sun and how it might affect things like, you know, radio communications and so much here on Earth, with a really feisty star, what further does it say about the possibility of life on its orbiting planets? I mean, does it make it less tenable or what?
It's a great question, and people are still trying to answer this. I mean, you could, on certain sides, it can, of course, be a negative. So it can, you know, this really energetic star can you know, set off these winds that can help strip away the atmosphere, which is, at least as far as we know, you know, based off of Earth, you need an atmosphere in order to have a habitable planet. Now, that may not be a requirement. We have, for example, you know, the ocean-rich moons in our solar system, like Europa or Enceladus. So potentially, you know, whether there could be life underneath, you know, these deep oceans, we don't know. But if you assume you need an atmosphere, then these stars can be a negative because they might help strip away the atmosphere. But there's been a lot of work done on this, and I don't think that we know for sure. It's not completely clear. Also, you know, we have to think that we are viewing these planets at a snapshot in time, you know, and how they have formed to their present day state. That's a whole other question. So of course, you know, if the M dwarfs are already active right now, this maybe doesn't bode super great for what they were like in you know, the earlier phase of this system when the star was also forming, the planets were forming. But I think what most people are thinking now based off of our observations with JWST is that the innermost planets in this TRAPPIST system, it's looking like they probably don't have atmospheres at all. And that could be due to multiple things. Of course, the host star and just in general being much closer in to the star in a more intense radiation environment. But maybe the ones that are a little bit further out, they could still potentially hold on to their atmosphere. So this is work that we're, you know, there's observations that people are looking at right now, and hopefully we'll have a better answer soon.
All right, Maggie, here's the big question, right? I mean, we're talking about atmospheres and exoplanets, and the thing I think that's on everyone's mind when we talk about this is, could there be life on other planets? And I know that this gets people in all the sciences very, very excited, but in particularly, I've got to imagine in your research, you've sat up in the middle of the night and said, wow, I wonder, do you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think I very much take the, I'm trying to remember now. I think it's Carl Sagan that had this quote of just, you know, like really like the odds of just the universe being so vast that if it's really just us, that seems like a waste of space. I think it's him. And if I'm wrong, somebody said that once. So I certainly take that approach. I do believe there's got to be life out there in some form. But I do think it's really important the way at which we go about searching for it. So, you know, one of the ways that the community has been approaching this is to think about what we call biosignatures. So these are going to be either a gas molecule or maybe a group of gas molecules that we see in the atmosphere of a planet that is really hard to explain without life. And so this requires, though, a lot of work, both looking at our own planet and our own planet's history to say, okay, yeah, what would be the conditions for a particular molecule? So in my research, I have spent some time thinking about methane, which is right now in Earth's atmosphere, not a super significant, you know, gas molecule in our atmosphere. You know, you think about methane emissions from cows, for example, right now, or, you know, certain natural gas, things like that, but it's not a dominant gas molecule. But earlier in our planet's history, before we had this rise of oxygen and photosynthesis, methane was probably a lot more dominant. If you looked at our Earth as an exoplanet billions of years ago, and you took a spectra of its atmosphere, you would probably see a lot of methane. And so one of the things we thought about is, yeah, so what makes this methane in our planet, what made that representative of life? And so that requires, when we think about biosignatures, you have to go through and think about all the ways in which you can create methane without life, because there are ways to do it. Volcanoes can emit methane. We have reactions in the oceans with rocks and water that can generate methane. Also, early on in our planet's history, we had a lot of comets and impacts that can produce some methane. So it's going through and kind of thinking about these potential false positives, because we don't want to get it wrong, and then saying, okay, maybe there's another gas that if it's also present, maybe that's really hard to explain without life. So those are the sorts of things that we have to go through and think about biosignatures. Maybe one day we can also look at like the surface of planets. So some people have thought about, they call it ocean glint, which I think is really cool. Like, you know, if you look at an image of the Earth, and you know how the ocean can look kind of shiny, could you maybe detect that somehow, like for an exoplanet, to infer that there's an ocean? So yeah, there's a lot of exciting things, but the main focus is on gases in the atmosphere.
Wow, Maggie, it sounds like the further we look out, the closer we're looking at ourselves. And as this is fascinating, and the discoveries of exoplanets, has it reshaped your own way that you maybe understand our own solar system?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it also kind of goes back into your question about Mars. I mean, it's so important now, you know, not just from the perspective of it's really fascinating to explore our solar system, but I think there's like a new reason now to want to understand Mars. And I also really think, importantly, Venus, actually, which, you know, has been, you know, a planet that, you know, we sent and you know, different countries sent probes to, you know, way back. And it's sort of a hellish environment. It's very hard to send spacecraft to Venus because it's so hot on the surface and it's got this thick atmosphere. But I think now people are really appreciating these three planets that we have, Venus, Earth, and Mars. Only one of them is habitable today. And so if we can understand how that happened, and if Venus or Mars were ever habitable in their past, sort of what went wrong, that gives us so much more context. Because yeah, right now we have one system, we have one planet Earth that we can use to sort of say, well, this is how life works here. But if we can understand it for other planets and understand the context of our solar system, I think that will be tremendously helpful.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a wonderful conversation with Maggie Thompson. She researches exoplanets, and we're trying to understand how exoplanets and what we're finding about exoplanets translate back to life here. And, you know, you've been talking a little bit about, you know, climate, and how does your work affect our climate models?
Yes. So our work draws quite heavily a lot of the time on models that have existed for a long time to understand the climate of Earth. And, you know, when we think about these models, and I think sometimes I certainly fall victim to this, if you're, you know, reading a article about something cool in astronomy and maybe someone brings up a model, it seems a little bit like a black box. You're like, oh, okay, that's great, but who knows what really went into that. And so, you know, we have levels of complexity when it comes to models. I actually tend to work on very, very simple ones. So some that we maybe even just call a box model, where I want to say, you know, I'm interested in how certain gas molecules will behave if you assume you're right at the surface of a planet. I'm interested in which of those gas molecules might dissolve into the interior of your planet. This is looking in particular at an early phase, like much earlier that I was talking about with methane. When rocky planets form, they probably go through at least one, if not several, of what we call magma ocean phases. So they're really hot when they form, so the surface is fully molten. So you can actually dissolve some of your species, just like you can dissolve, you know, you're mixing, you know, sugar in water or something like that. You can dissolve it into the interior of your planet. And so I do very simple models to say, okay, yeah, how would water, for example, how much water will stay in the atmosphere, how much will go into the interior? But you can build up this complexity. You can say, well, actually, wait, I want this to be at least one dimensional. I want to be able to say, how does this translate all the way up to the top of the atmosphere, closer to where we will observe it with JWST, all the way to what people do quite commonly to think about Earth climate modeling, which is what we call general circulation models, or GCN. So these are three-dimensional models. You know, you can look at clouds. You can try to not only go over the entire like surface of your planet, but also, you know, into deeper layers from the surface all the way to the top. So those are much more complicated, but they all fit together, because even the very simple box models, those results are very important for then informing, you know, what sort of inputs we put into these subsequent ones. So there's many layers to it. What I'm interested in is a lot of times the simpler ones, and then I can tell my colleagues that work on the very complex ones how to maybe tweak things here and there.
Oh, I love it. Maggie, you are a brilliant young woman. You make all of this so easy to understand, and I really enjoy talking to you about this. It's my understanding that your father founded Orbital, which became Orbital ATK, which became Northrop Grumman, which worked on the rocket boosters for the James Webb Space Telescope. This is a wild full circle. Wow. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I'm super lucky. I come from a very space-forward family. I love my parents and love my dad. Both of them were huge, you know, Star Trek fans. So I grew up as a baby, like crawling over to the TV when the Star Trek theme song came on. And so I have been surrounded by space my whole life. And I think both my parents really gave me that curiosity of thinking about what is out there. You know, we would just go out in the middle of the night, look up at the stars. I'm super thankful. And you know, I learned so much from them, and getting to, you know, watch the work that my dad would do with helping to build and then launch these really exciting science satellites. You know, and I would say, what's this one going to do? You know, sometimes, you know, growing up, I would just hear it would be some acronym, you know, and I wouldn't know much about what it meant. And then I learned, oh, you know, this one's going to go to an asteroid, or, you know, this one is, yeah, exactly, going to, you know, help with launching JWST. And so I think it really sparked my curiosity for the field, and sort of opened my eyes to it in a way that, I'm incredibly thankful for.
Wow, that's great. What a wonderful story.
So Maggie, I know you grew up literally in the field, and I know that your parents helped you launch your career, but what future missions or technologies excite you right now the most? And what do you hope that we'll be able to answer maybe just in the next decade?
That's a great question. Well, so I'll answer the first one in terms of exciting missions, and this would be beyond this decade, although there's a ton of work that we will do in this decade to help prepare for this. But, you know, we're always thinking about the next big thing when it comes to space-based observatories. So JWST, you know, I'm knocking on wood, will be around for a long time and give us so much amazing data. But the successor mission to that is currently in the planning, and it's called the Habitable Worlds Observatory, HWO. And the goal for that mission will be to actually, you know, hopefully with JWST, we'll have identified a set of planets that we think, okay, these ones are really promising potentially for hosting life. You know, they're the right distance from their star. Maybe we've observed a few things in their atmosphere that are promising. But this mission is going to be dedicated to looking at those and looking for signs of life, you know, really being able to get at things like oxygen in the atmosphere, or ozone, methane, for example, CO2, all of these things that, you know, are important for life. So I'm super excited about that. And there's a lot of planning that we need to do, and the community is already working on. So that gives me a lot of excitement and hope. More in the next decade, what I'm really excited about is I think that, you know, astronomy for a while, I would say really kind of up until this discovery of all of these exoplanets, you know, was fairly a separate field from, say, geology or earth science. Yeah. And these fields are now really coming together. And I think that's really exciting. And so the thing that I'm really looking forward to is actually I spend a lot of my time in the lab. So I do lab experiments on rock samples or even like synthetic. We like create rock samples and we're trying to understand their behavior under different conditions that could be representative of what is happening on an exoplanet. And so right now there's a lot of exciting new technology to be able to push things really high in temperature space. I work on a really cool system that heats rocks with lasers so that we can go up to like thousands of degrees Celsius, very, very hot, and melt them. And also other instruments that allow you to go to really, really high pressures, which is going to be important for understanding. I mentioned these abundant sub-Neptunes, which are going to be puffier. They're bigger. If you were to go down, if they have a surface, the pressure at that surface pressure is going to be very intense, like you've scuba dived very, very, very deep down. And so we need to understand what happens at these higher pressures. And so we have amazing tools. And I think in the next decade, we're going to be able to make a lot of links with the observations that we're seeing. And these experiments here on Earth can tell us, this is how this molecule got there. This is how this atmosphere has come to be.
Well, Dr. Maggie Thompson, we want to have you back, I don't know, maybe every year to give us the updates on these exoplanets. Can you agree to that?
Sure, absolutely. We'd be happy to.
This is a really fun conversation. Dr. Maggie Thompson is our guest, and she is, okay, this is a mouthful, but it's great. She's a NASA Hubble Fellowship Program Sagan Postdoctoral Fellow at Carnegie EPL. And she is our guest today, among many other titles that I'll spare our listeners to hear it all. The bottom line is you're really accomplished and you're young and you're vibrant and energetic and you really explain this stuff very well. So thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much, Ren and Scott. No, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab or on the KPCW app or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. And if you liked today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.